Welcome to Fairbanks Arts Review. I'm Robert Gilfil and your host. On tonight's program, we'll hear about the literary adventures of the Chilkoot Trail.
Well, that's a pretty modest account of what was really a very exciting ride and quite an accomplishment. But I think that it's in the Aeneid. We would have had the epic poet telling us about being dashed between Scylla and Charybdis, and there would have been some connection with the underworld, and the gods would have been somehow involved in that. But Thompson just takes this rather matter-of-factly.
Dramatic letters to the editor.
I think it's also not only a story about Alaska, but about America, and about the American individual, about westward expansion, about the American dream.
And Alaska Land Celluloid. So stay tuned for Fairbanks Arts Review. For the last two summers, the English department of the university has offered a course called North to the Klondike, the Trail of 98. In it, students study the writings of the miners and pioneers who crossed the Chilkoot Pass in search of gold. After this body of writing has been digested, the students actually climb the trail with backpacks and equipment and experience the land they've read about. Dr. Frank Buskey, who heads the English department, is a specialist in these writings, and I asked him if the class was a field trip or a course of study.
Well, it's actually both of these things. It's a class, a part of which can be the experience of walking over the Chilkoot Trail itself. The way we've been handling it in the past, the students come to the classroom for the first week, and we read various accounts of the crossing of the Chilkoot Pass as performed by the gold miners, or the would-be gold miners of 1897, 1898. And then the second week, we drive down to Haines, take the ferry over to Skagway, and put packs on our backs, and we walk over the Chilkoot Pass.
Now, when you say you studied the writings of the miners and the people who walked over it, where did you find a body of literature like that?
Well, many of the people who made the actual trip wrote journals, or later on they published books about it. You know the American commercial spirit at the time that the gold rush became big news around the world. Everybody who'd been to Alaska or to the Yukon Territory rushed to put down everything that he knew about it, a sort of I was on the spot or I can tell you all about it kind of literature. And a great number of these books were circulated widely, sold very many copies. And then there was also a popular rush to capitalize on the dime novel series. I think something like 100 titles came out. They were supposed to be books for children or young people, you know. Something like Boy Chums in the Yukon, Finding the Gold Mines, all this kind of thing. It was big news. It was something that sold, and so that's how a lot of these accounts came into being. The newspapers covered the gold rush very widely. The magazines sent reporters up here. Some very famous writers came up and sent back accounts. So it was. Shall we dare use the term media event?
Oh, go ahead. Let's be daring.
So the most interesting writing, of course, grew out of the experience. These books were published some years after the event itself, and perhaps lack some of the immediacy of the accounts that the contemporary accounts. But the one thing that interests me about, or one of the things that interests me, is that whatever kind of writing came out of the period, there was really no first-class poetry written during the gold rush itself. And many people regard Robert Service as a first-class poet. I think that is an extreme evaluation of his accomplishment. And the only person I know who wrote verse during the period, Sam Dunham, was actually not a poet. He was a versifier. He wrote some very interesting, timely things, Alaska to Uncle Sam, all this kind of thing. But, the thing got into print pretty quickly and pretty thoroughly, and we still have all of those accounts available to us.
Well, tell me, that's a field of literature I'm not familiar with, or I don't know if it's been explored too well, that sort of popular or adventure writing per se in terms of Alaskan experience. What is it like? Is it well written for the most part?
Well, actually, no, it isn't well written. It has this sort of breathless quality. It tries to suggest that the persons participating in this were somehow larger than life, that they partook of heroic qualities, that they... who was it? I think it was Stephen Crane who said that heroism had to have its spectators. And I think that most of the writing that comes out of this period fulfills that particular comment, that these were persons who believed that they were accomplishing great things, and heaven knows they certainly were, but that they also had to have the applause of the outside world to know about. The readers of the newspapers, the magazines, had to know about this and had to say good things about them. So vanity plays a part in it. Of course, adventure literature is a staple and has always been for writers, and it satisfies that particular need of human beings also.
I have a funny question.
Yes.
Do you consider, if this had been the age of epic poetry, that a Homer or a Virgil would have written about this?
Well, no. The kinds of things that some of the Argonauts, as they called themselves, did suggest some of the adventures of Odysseus or of Aeneas. But one is not really involved with enormous forces. One is not in conflict with the gods or trying to accomplish things. This is sort of, well, of course, the word Argonauts takes us back to Jason and the Golden Fleece, doesn't it? So at least some of the persons who were involved had some kind of classical background. But to go and dig gold out of the ground hardly sounds like the kinds of great deeds that these classical heroes accomplished. So I'm not sure that they would have found material for epics there. I think that's a pretty grand term for the kind of thing that was accomplished during the Gold Rush.
So when they're talking about this sort of awestruck encounter with nature and overcoming it and grappling it, what type of things do they say? What type of observations do they make on the trail and on their voyage and eventual realization of Alaskan's dream?
Well, most of the accounts tend not to be very introspective. I suppose one of the great charms about much of the writing is the fact that it is so understated that it simply tells what happens. Well, perhaps I can give you some example here. I brought along a copy of Fred Thompson's journal, which is very interesting and significant because the party included a Mr. Shepherd, a Merritt Sloper, a man named Jim Goodman, and last but not least, a man named Jack London. And London did not write the journal, but he very much participated in the adventure. And here is an account of these intrepid Argonauts as they come to a place that they called Box Canyon, but it's known today as Miles Canyon. And it was indeed a difficult stretch of water to get through because of, well, let me just give you the account as Thompson writes it. Up bright and early, snowing and cold, started downriver again, got very cold, so went ashore and built a fire, got warm and had something to eat. Jim went out to try and shoot a moose but saw nothing, started downriver again, snowing stopped, came to Box Canyon, which we shot after taking a look at it with everything in our boat, Jack at stern, Sloper at bow, Jim and myself at the oars. The ride was a swift one, as the river at the point narrows to about 30 feet, and the water dashes and rolls through this narrow box with walls from 50 to 100 feet high at a great speed, making it rather dangerous to enter. But as our boat was large and strong, we did not feel alarmed to make the run. And as it was, we made the run in 3 minutes, otherwise it would have taken us 4 days to pack around. After getting through, Jack and Sloper went back and ran Mr. and Mrs. Rhett's boats through for them. Went on to White Horse Rapids, 3 miles below the canyon, and after taking a look at them, decided we could make the run in safety. Mr. Tarwater walked around, and with every pound in our boat, Jack at stern, Sloper at bow, and Jim and myself at oars, we made the start with about 1,000 people standing on the banks watching us. We made the run in safety, taking in just a little spray twice. Jack and Sloper then went back and ran boat through for Mr. and Mrs. Rhett in safety. Pitched camp below White Horse, had our supper, and went to bed with our minds easy. Well, that's a pretty modest account of what was really a very exciting ride and quite an accomplishment. But I think that it's in the Aeneid. We would have had the epic poet telling us about being dashed between Scylla and Charybdis, and there would have been some connection with the underworld, and the gods would have been somehow involved in that. But Thompson just takes this rather matter-of-factly. One of the interesting things about this is, of course, it tells how London was in the stern for, I think, a total of 4 trips through the 2 canyons, which pretty well sets to rest that fanciful legend that we have that he stayed there guiding boats through and made $1,500 and so forth and so on. That's part of the folklore of the North, but it doesn't square with the contemporary records.
Well, this lack of imagination or matter-of-fact quality in the writings of these explorers, do you think that has a corollary with the fact that they couldn't afford too much imagination because when you're in danger or in constant danger, I think it's in Lord Jim that Conrad makes the observation that it's the imagination that causes fear?
Well, I think that the problem is that we're dealing with people who were not particularly imaginative to start out with. It was imaginative of them to believe that they could cross the pass and get to the Klondike and dig out the gold, but they were not persons who had been involved in creative activities before they went on the trip. They were persons who had been clerks in stores or policemen or firemen or occupations with which we do not usually associate a great deal of imagination. So these are people who are writing what interested them, what seemed important to them. And so there were some famous writers who went. Joaquin Miller went, for example. And he was known as the poet of the Sierras and had had a great deal of success both in London and in the United States. And the accounts that he sent back are very fanciful. He tells about strolling across the Chilkoot Pass with a bunch of violets in his hand and big game abounding all over the place. Well, nobody else saw these things, and if there were violets in the Chilkoot Pass, this escaped the attention of all the other walkers. It certainly escaped my attention when I walked through there. So, but and Hamlin Garland took the Canadian trail from Edmonton in an attempt to get there. And he is pretty straightforward in detailing the agonies and difficulties they went through. Of course, that was the very worst trail of all to go. And anybody who's driven the Alaska Highway knows that if you started out on foot with all of your gear from Edmonton to walk up to Whitehorse, that's a considerable journey and a very difficult one. So, no, but to get back to your point again, it's simply the nature of the people who went. And when they wrote accounts of this, they didn't think they were writing literature. They were just saying, hey, look what I did, and wasn't I a great person to have done this, to have accomplished this?
Pierre Burton, when he was here and I was talking with him, said that Northerners as a whole tend to be more phlegmatic. And I asked you yesterday, and it's a question that I think about, is whether the climate may have also contributed to the sort of tightness of prose or...
Well, if all of the persons who took part in the gold rush had come from northern climates, I would be tempted to say yes, but that isn't the case because they came from all over the West Coast, both the southern and the northern parts. They came from many other countries in the world where this, where these climate conditions do not apply. And so I don't think that is the case. It may perhaps be true for those persons who came from, say, Scandinavia or from the northern parts of Canada, which was not too thickly populated at that time. It may also have been true of the miners who were on the ground in the 40-mile area or in Circle, who then dashed over to Dawson. And but those are not the persons whose accounts we are reading. The ones that we are reading about are the ones who got on board the boat in Seattle and then came on up through the Inside Passage and got off in Skagway or Dyea and then went on over the trail. So I don't think that I agree with that.
Do you think, and I asked you this yesterday too, do you think someone like Walt Whitman could have composed Songs of the Open Road on the Chilkoot Trail?
Well, that was kind of a sneaky question. So this morning I went to look up the poem Song of the Open Road, and I take a different reading of that. It seems more of an invitation to join in comradeship or brotherly activity, and that, of course, is not excluded because there was a strong sense of comradeship on the trail, and many persons felt strong bonds for all the persons who were undergoing the same experiences they were. So I don't really know how to answer that. He might well have come to say the same things after he had participated in this, but the poem is more generalized in what it has to say about human relations. And so, yes and no. How about that?
That's a pretty safe answer. Maybe you should run for office. Well, another question I have is, it reflects on your students. I'd be keen to hear how they react to the course and actually walking after studying these writings. But do these writers speak to us today? Do they have anything to tell us about ourselves as Alaskans or ourselves as human beings?
Well, again, yes and no. First of all, the students are very enthusiastic about the trip. The first day, they always grumble about how heavy their packs are, and perhaps they're carrying, say, 40 to 50 pounds. But that's a far cry from Fred Thompson's journal, in which he speaks at one point, if I can find it very quickly. Yes, we are now at Pleasant Camp, 3 miles from Sheep Camp. It is raining this morning, but still we go. Cross the river 3 times on logs, one tied across the other, are very hard to walk, with the water rushing underneath, with 100 pounds on your back, but are over them now and think we will be at Sheep Camp tomorrow. So, but after they sort of get into the rhythm of it, then they find it's a very interesting experience for them. They don't have the same things at stake, of course, except to complete the trip. And it is not always easy, because when you get to the Golden Stairs, as the Chilkoot part itself is called, the climb is sort of like climbing up a ladder against the side of a house, and you are in all fours, and there's snow, and you're puffing and panting and moving very slowly. So part of that is there. But as to what it says to us today, I suppose, it's this: if we feel the same kind of challenge, the need to overcome, the need to prove our ability to confront the wilderness successfully, yes, then it has something to say. And if we want to measure ourselves against that kind of standard, then what is there is something that we can read with interest and profit. But I don't know that I necessarily advocate carrying 100 pounds over the Chilkoot.
What amazed me, you mentioned this yesterday, was the fact that for many of these people, they met with disappointment in the terms of when they arrived at wherever they were headed to, they found that their expectations weren't met and they headed back again, but they didn't feel that the journey had been wasted or a loss in any way.
No, that's true, and that's a very interesting thing, even about some of the miners who struck it rich. Who would then simply take their pokes of gold out to the South 48, go on a wild orgy of spending and come back again, and didn't care that they were broke. They'd had a wonderful time, but in the meantime, they could then go through again the search, and the search was the important thing. And if you enjoyed the search, then the fact that you didn't get rich in the process was not important. But you had proven something to yourself. You'd had a good time. John Muir, in one of his letters from southeastern Alaska, at the time of the gold rush, he happened to be down there on another project, wrote back and said that, of course, not many people would strike gold or find it, but that it would be a very good experience for them because they'd get out and they would see nature and they would breathe the fresh air and they'd get all that good exercise. And so he said, oh, no, by all means, go and do it if that's what you want to do, but don't be disappointed if you get rich. And I think that he was simply, well, of course, he had a great deal of money himself. He could afford to talk like that. But so I think he was simply reflecting what he had observed, that it was the experience itself that was important.
Well, you know, in a way, it's too bad that some poet didn't record that, or because that's a marvelous metaphor for life, or at least, you know, a lesson to apply to life, it seems to me, is that, you know, the process is what's important. I don't want to wax too romantic here.
How about, it's not whether you win or lose, but how you play the game?
Maybe not. Maybe I was wrong about that.
That was Dr. Frank Buskey of the university's English department talking with me about the popular course North to the Klondike, the Trail of 98. The literary taste of the Fairbanks community extends further afield than the journal entries of its pioneers. In fact, it seems to me the most talked about body of writing in our town is the letters sent to the editor of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. Melinda Matheson of Fairbanks Drama Association has compiled some of these epistles and fashioned them into a play, fittingly called Letters to the Editor. This is the second year it's been performed, and it's been updated to include some very topical material. I asked Melinda where she got the idea for the play.
Well, it came about as an evening in February about 2 years ago, and we were sitting around reading the letters to the editor. And Richard, my husband, who's is an actor, recited one, and we suddenly had the idea altogether that it would be a wonderful evening of theater.
And it certainly is. I had an opportunity to see it this Saturday, and I was very impressed not only with the way it was presented, and I want to talk about the structure and how you organize the play, but also by the performers themselves. We can talk about them, too, in a little bit. But this isn't the first year Letters to the Editor has been performed.
No, I did it last year with 12 actors. This year there are 7. It was real exciting last year. A lot of energy went into the creation of this new thing. And I had the opportunity to play with it, see what worked, what didn't work. And this production is, I think, represents some improvements. I think I've lost my objectivity. I'm not sure whether it's better or not than it was last year. I think in certain respects it is. But it's something that I would like to continue doing over the next few years, keep going back, digging up new material, doing some more research, and synthesizing it down a little bit until possibly, I guess, I'd like to see it become a less regional piece eventually, and I think that there's certainly that potential, although certainly a large part of its charm is because it is so distinctly interior Alaskan, and I wouldn't want to lose that altogether. But I think it's also not only a story about Alaska, but about America and about the American individual, about westward expansion, about the American dream, and which takes it beyond the bounds of a merely regional piece, although that's nothing bad either.
Mm-hmm. When you set about to research this and structure the play, what did you have in mind? How did you decide to make letters dramatic?
Well, when I started research, I didn't have any idea of what I was going to find, and I just simply took notes on every letter I read. And my research, of course, is only maybe one-fourth done, and there's thousands and thousands of more letters to be explored. But really, it was a matter of taking the time that I had, which was, you know, a few months to do the research, going through my notes and deciding what letters I wanted, going in and copying them, and then having this big box of copied letters. And I just started pulling the ones that I liked the best, and they told me what to do. And I wanted to get that feeling of looking back and looking forward that I think is a recurring and basic kind of theme in the letters, that people are trying to find their level in this day and age, and some of them go back to a former time, and some look to the future. And, of course, I'm real intrigued with the stories of the early days, and there's a lot of them in there. And so that seemed like a good place to begin, were those people who first came here, because it's like Fairbanks is a town of prolonged, of transients, people coming here and then staying or leaving and coming back. And it's always a place where people, they're curious about it, they come up here. Militaries brought them up, the gold brought them up originally. And exploring, you know, why, what happened in terms of the individual and trying to find a place and creating a community from all this, these different individuals with a drive for gold or isolation or whatever they came up here for.
And the play starts out with something like a monologue. Now, that wasn't a letter, was it, isn't it Jean DeWilde begins with a...
That was a letter that was written in 1958. That's a bona fide letter. And the early comments as the play opens, which are referring to projection, some of that is manufactured, but most of it is based on letters that were written in response to a series of archival photographs that were printed in the News Miner back in 1958. And pioneers wrote in reference to the letters and describing what they were and what they weren't, and there was some disagreement and things. But some of it is manufactured, too, just to give an opportunity to show the scope of the kinds of things we'll be going into in the play itself.
Now, I noticed that throughout the play, some of the performers assume, I mean, there's a lot of costume changes, but there are some characters that seem to retain a costume throughout several different letters in order to become a type almost, so that there's the angry individualist who likes his guns and his law and order, and he wears a stocking cap, and then there are other ones, but that's the one that comes to mind, so that there's some sort of continuity of character, if not type.
Yeah, some of them are definitely characters, like one of our actors portrays all of the Fred Stickman letters. Of course, letters to the editor would be nothing without those particular letters. But some of them, many of them are distinct individuals who wrote time and time again. And other times they are simply, as you say, types, recurring types. And basically, the costume choices were left to the actors. It was a matter of them finding some piece that could identify in their mind and the minds of the audience, sort of help people frame off, because a lot goes on. There's all different kinds of, you know, a flow of characters, and usually there's a character only occurs once, but then there are those few times when they don't. Choice of costumes, as I said, was just simply an actor choice, mostly.
And you have them interspersed. You have a stage setting. You have the audience in a sort of an L or a open-ended square shape so that they can almost envelop the actors. But the actors also have little platforms that are on either side of the auditorium or on the audience. Is this, in a sense, to make them more human, to interact with the audience a little
bit
more?
Well, my idea was to try to involve the audience as much as possible. It's a piece that is has been evolved, gleaned from writings of our neighbors and the people who have made this community and this area. And I felt like it was a preferable staging choice. In terms, of course, our theater, which allows us to do that, I don't know what I would do with it if it was a proscenium piece. For some reason, that seems to me a real important part of why it works. And also, of course, it's very informally presented. The actors are there greeting their friends in the audience as the audience comes in to sit before the show has begun. One of our actors serves lemonade at intermission. And that I wish to break down that formal aspect that usually, that ritualistic aspect of going into a theater and being given a play. I mean, that's very good, but I felt like it was preferable to do more informal.
It seemed absolutely appropriate. I mean, I enjoyed the play very much. I don't know if play is even really what you'd call something like this, but whatever it is, I enjoyed it very much, and I did have a sense of interaction and identity with the actors that I wouldn't normally have. There would always be that sort of sense of detachment of viewing something instead of, in a sense, participating with something. I also really liked the use of slides and sound in that, in order to, there's no program, and the actors are identified by terms of a slide projector. Why did you go that way?
Well, I felt like, certainly, especially in Act One, which is historical and chronological, that I felt like certainly people who are not familiar with the history of the area, that it would help them identify where they were in time. And I think that certainly for Act One, that I think probably most audience members feel more comfortable if they can place a letter in a certain period of time or in a certain location. By Act Two, I feel the projections become less and less important, and certainly the structure of the play becomes more fluid and not historical at all. It's an interesting technique, and it seemed like just the logical thing to do, although I'm in the process of trying to figure out how to do and identify the action without projections, mainly because I'm putting it together, a one-hour piece, to go down to the Haynes competition in April, the community theater competition. And I'd like to just simplify it and take it down to its barest essentials. Maybe a good sound tape, because there are some sounds there that I just hate to let go of. But the projections would present us a problem, so I'm sort of thinking how to make it work without. And of course, I've gotten so used to it, I'm almost afraid of the prospect whether this thing will work for outsiders without those kinds of pieces of information.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said last year you had 12 performers,
mm-hmm.
and you have 7 this year. Why did you pare it down?
Oh, gosh, 12 people make so much noise. No, my 12 actors, I had a wonderful group last year, and they really told me a whole lot about the material that I had. I sort of was going for a wide variety of type last year, and I've tried to do that again this year. I did it mainly because, of course, practical considerations. In the summer, it's difficult to get actors. And 12 actors in the summer is just a whole lot. And if we were ever to really try to take this show around, that it might be better if it could be honed down to half a dozen actors to make it a more mobile piece.
Well, you have an awfully strong cast. What do you tell them when you're directing them about characterization?
Well, I'll tell you, this show is the greatest one in the world, because all you have to do is tell an actor at any time the person whose letter you are interpreting, that person could be sitting right there in the audience. So say it like you believe it. I mean, conviction is absolutely essential. Whether you agree with the text of the letter or not is immaterial. As an actor, and of course this is true of any kind of show, you have to believe what you're saying at the moment you say it. And if you can make yourself do that, you can make everybody else believe that you believe what you're saying. And I think that kind of pressure, that knowledge of this person could really be out there, and occasionally they have been, keeps them honest. And I think that actors get terribly indulgent, but this piece will keep them honest.
You have some cute interactions throughout the play. For example, at one point, Mary Hamilton and it's Bruce's brother, isn't it?
Yes. T.J.
T.J.
Rogers, yes.
And I understand this is his first performance.
Yes.
He's quite good.
I know.
I've been trying
to get him into a show for 2 years. He is principal at Tanana.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So.
But you have a cute interaction between Mary Hamilton, who's, of course, a very short woman, and T.J., who towers above her. And it's a cute little shtick, but you injected this. I mean, it's not simply a question of just making these characters believable or human. You also do a nice pacing job to keep the flow and movement to the eye going.
Well, thank you. I think that probably one of my strong suits, certainly in putting together something like this, is, of course, many years of doing community theater and university theater and working with good, you know, with the finest literature. That I also have a sense as a visual artist of design and spatial relationships and emotional relationships. And, of course, in this sort of piece where you do have a variety, heaven knows, of material, there's no point for it. I mean, if it ever gets boring, you have no excuse. I come from possibly the depth charge philosophy of making of playmaking. First of all, I have to say here that I had to watch my own honesty, you know, and try not to let my own biases come through too often, although they do. And I slip them in, and then just turn back on myself again and flip-flop into something that's perhaps outlandish, you know, like flip-flopping from that John Bircher, who is advocating a stronger government and very anti-environmentalist, and flip-flopping from that into the dry rata.
That was great. Listen, where did you get that? I mean, that was such a clever piece.
That's one of my not quite honest pieces. It's not really a letter. It's a piece that was written by a man named Daniel Bloom, who works out of Juneau. And he was here a couple in 1980. He published the Alaska Dry Rata and sent it out to people for $1. And you get this little parchment with the dry rata on it. It's hysterical. Well, I wrote to him and asked if I could use it in this play, which was really not altogether fair because it wasn't really a letter. But it just seemed to suit the spirit of the piece. And certainly this, even though it was written after the pipeline, to me it suited that kind of craziness of that time and that trying to balance off all the different aspects of our culture, you know, the desire for maintaining the wilderness and the necessity of oil and the influx of Texans and Oklahomans. And it was just sort of a madcap kind of thing that I just wanted to do. And frankly, I think it's a classic piece of Alaskan comedy.
It is. I was in stitches throughout the entire performance and that section in particular. Well, listen, if anybody wants to go down and see Letters to the Editor, how many weekends do they have left to do that in?
We have three more weekends. We play Thursday, Friday, and Saturday through August 4th. And anyone liking to get tickets can stop by our theater anytime between noon and 5 o'clock Monday through Friday, or give us a call at 456-PLAY to make a reservation.
And I highly recommend it for anybody out there who likes Alaskana or likes good theater. It's both. Thank you.
Thank you.
Melinda Matheson of Fairbanks Drama Association and the author and director of their current production, Letters to the Editor. Regular listeners to Fairbanks Arts Review know that Laurel Stocky of Alaskaland Cinema is a regular guest on the show, and she's back with us tonight to run down the film she'll be showing in the coming weeks.
I see at the top of the list is The Seven Samurai, and as I told you before, just before we went on the air here, it is one of my favorite films. In fact, it's probably my most favorite film in the whole wide world.
It's probably because you're a man. Not to say it's not a good film. It's an excellent film, an adventure film. It has a theme in common with another film we've got on our schedule there, The Wages of Fear, the last one on the schedule there, the French film.
Uh-huh.
Because they're both about a group of men accomplishing impossible tasks, you know, at great personal risk. Seven Samurai being about the samurai. 16th century Japan, I guess. All the different warring factions, and the farmers hire these group of hungry samurai. All they can afford to give the samurai to protect them is food. So they find this kind of motley group of hungry samurai that will work for just food and hire them to protect their lands.
You know what's amazing? That's the whole style of the Seven Samurai has a particular name in Japanese literature and in film. And for lack of the better word, it's like a sword picture or a Western for us. But what Kurosawa manages to do with just a Western, let's say, to put it in American idiom, is he brings in so much humanity. And he transforms the characters from two-dimensional adventurers into three-dimensional caring human beings who ultimately sacrifice themselves not for either food or for fame, but just because they've committed themselves to other human beings and they care about someone else.
Right, and I think all the characters are developed in his film. We get to know each of the seven samurai, especially Toshiro Mifune.
Mifune.
He plays kind of a crazed, half-crazed samurai. In fact, he's not a samurai. He's a mock samurai. He kind of forged his papers to become a samurai. He was a farmer's son, right? And in his famous scene where that's revealed, you can see that he hates the samurai because they've caused the farmers to become cowards, and he hates the farmers because they are cowards, and it's revealed that he's a farmer's son and not a real samurai.
And I think that's why he's such a pivotal character, even though my favorite character is Takashi Shimura, who's the head, the guy who shaves his head in the picture. But Mifune is so good because he's so ambivalent about his life, and he comes to terms with it by committing himself to the farmers and to the samurai and transcending that.
His character's kind of boxed in there.
And he manages to overcome it. It's just a spectacular film. The black and white photography is also stunning, too. The editing's fast-paced, and yet you have this amazing shot. Kurosawa's not afraid to keep a camera still for a long period of time to tell a story. And there's a really fascinating scene where this woman is weeping by the fire, and her young lover is standing there right next to her, and the father of her, who's just shamed her in front of the whole village, is standing at another point. And you see it's at night, and there's this brilliant fire in between. You see this triangle of tension. The fire's there, and then suddenly the rain comes and extinguishes the fire, and Kurosawa just keeps that camera there to explore that dynamic situation.
He uses three cameras, I think, almost throughout the whole film. One for action shots, one for still and close-up, and one just kind of guerrilla action, you know, wherever it's needed. And that's an amazing way to make a film.
He's a brilliant filmmaker, and this is one of, as I say, one of his finest films.
Yeah,
it's the most famous.
It's impressive that you're able to always know what's going on, even in the combat scenes. And in the rain, driving rainstorms, you know, because he uses three cameras and he edited it so well.
Oh, the editing is marvelous. It's just one of the world's best films, in my opinion. And that'll be showing next Monday through Wednesday.
The 23rd through the 25th.
Well, I recommend everybody to go see this film because it's a classic. And then following that is The Mad Magician. And tell me a little bit. I have no idea.
Well, The Mad Magician was also made in 1954, kind of for fun. Well, completely for fun. It's a 3D feature. And like all 3D features, it's so bad that it's good, you know. Vincent Price stars as a mad magician. He's got a chip on his shoulder, something about not being rewarded for his work or something, so he kills his employer and impersonates him.
Okay, all you employers out there, be careful, because after this film, there may be some mad employees.
There's more murders, more people catch on to him. He has to murder more people. Finally, he murders more people than he can impersonate, and that's the end of it. We're going to supply the 3D glasses, you know, with the red frame and the blue frame in them. And it's playing with a short version of The Creature from the Black Lagoon, an 18-minute short version of that 3D feature as well.
Do you know anything about that version? Why do they make an 18-minute version as something to fill in time for other films?
Maybe so. I'm not real sure.
That's interesting.
It's give you the highlights of it, maybe, without having to sit through the whole thing.
Gee, if it had been a television program, we'd have stop-action photography and instant replays for The Creature. So those are two 3D films that we can expect. And whatever happened, have they been doing any more 3D films?
I don't think so. I think that kind of faded out quickly because it's just a novelty thing. A lot of people can't see the 3D effect wearing those glasses. We've shown a 3D film in the past and had a lot of people complaining they couldn't see the 3D effect. I don't know why that is. It depends on your eyes, maybe, your depth of perception or something. And a lot of people get eye strain. I don't know. It's good for just a change of pace, but I don't think, you know, it can stand on its own.
Well, I'm look forward to it because it must have been so long ago that I saw a 3D film that I don't even remember what they were like. But Creature from the Black Lagoon and The Mad Magician. And coming up after that is a Howard Hawks film.
Right, To Have and Have Not. It's one of my favorites with Lauren Bacall and Humphrey Bogart.
And Walter Brennan turns in a really splendid little performance.
And Hoagy Carmichael.
Oh, that's right, right, Hoagy Carmichael. And this is the film that Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall met.
Mm-hmm. She was 19 years old, I think. And it's her famous scene, you know, if you want me, just whistle. You know how to whistle, right? We've shown this film once before, and when that line came up, there was just too much noise in the audience. Everybody was screaming and yelling because that's her famous line, and they heard it. It's kind of...
Did everybody try to repeat it in unison?
No. They just mostly laughed.
I remember reading the book, and it didn't really have a lot to do too much with Hemingway's novel.
No, and I can't even really remember the plot. Just, you know, intrigue and Martinique, smuggling someone out of or into Martinique. And it's just interesting watching Bogart and Bacall interact on the screen. And that's what I was seeing last time I saw that film.
Yeah, it is a good film.
And she's just beautiful.
Isn't she?
Mm-hmm. Gorgeous.
Stunning.
In that film.
And then coming up after that is Summertime. And David Lean, who was an excellent director, this must be an early one of his. He did, of course, Bridge on the River Kwai and Lawrence of Arabia.
I think he did Dr. Zhivago.
And Dr. Zhivago. Yeah. He's a big one for epics.
Uh-huh.
And but this isn't an epic, is it?
No, this is a romance. Kind of sad, you know. Poignant romance with Katharine Hepburn. I'm looking forward to seeing it. I've not seen it, but it sounds great. She stars as a spinster school teacher going on vacation in Venice. And it was made, 53? Where are we? 55. So she's no spring chicken, and she plays the role just perfectly, being a New England type, you know, tight-laced person, the perfect tourist in Venice. The first night she's there, she's wandering down the streets and acutely aware of being wandering alone in a city of lovers.
Hmm.
Well, she meets an owner of an antique store and falls in love with him and just throws caution to the wind and has this fling with this Italian. And there's a scene where she's waiting to meet him in a square in Venice, and a young man shows up and says he'll be late. And she starts talking to him and finds out it's the son of her lover.
Amazing.
And, of course, is crushed. And later he finds her, he looks her up at the place she's staying, and she decides to go ahead and continue out this romance, knowing that it's going to end with her having to go home and he'll have to stay there. But they turn in some pretty remarkable performances.
Sounds like it.
Mm-hmm. There's a famous scene where she's trying to photograph his antique store, and she can't frame it in her camera, so she keeps backing up. Of course, the canal is behind her. Ends up falling into the canal, and she had to do that scene herself. There was no way they could fake it. And she didn't want to, of course, because the way the canals are, they're pretty full of refuse. And she was coated with lotions and oils for this scene, and she did fall in and got a terrible eye infection from which she never really recovered. She looks kind of weepy in some of her later films.
Contracted that during the filming of this?
Yeah, right, from that fall. When she did that scene, it was a full-page spread in Life magazine when they used to do pictorials. It's the most famous scene of the whole film, I think.
Wow. Summertime. David Lean directing, Katharine Hepburn, Rossano Brazzi. Darren McGavin. Oh, that's interesting. And small bit player in a... Mm-hmm. What is this, MGM, maybe?
Yeah, I think it would be MGM. Yeah. Katharine Hepburn.
And then finally, on this list here, we have The Wages of Fear, which is a French film. And again, I know nothing about this. Can you...
Well, it's an adventure film. It's about a group of people who are desperate to get out of the small town they're in, and they're hired to drive truckloads of nitroglycerin up mountainous paths. To what end? I'm not sure. I think they're going to use it to put out a fire by exploding the fire, you know. And so it's the men having to deal with their... Well, what can I say? Their identities and, you know, dealing under stress, men doing the best they can under stress, I guess, you know, getting right down to the base levels.
Men pitted against incredible odds.
Nitroglycerin. Impossible tasks.
Right. They'd probably just drink the nitroglycerin and let the fire worry about itself.
About camaraderie, you know, the code of men under stress and all that.
Well, taking a quick glance here at the notes, I noticed that it's about an American oil field.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a French film. Isn't that seems a little odd. Did they come over to America to film it, I wonder?
I think it's filmed in France. maybe that's, I don't know.
It'll be interesting to see...
American oil tycoons, I don't know. I haven't seen this film. I've only read about it and thought it looked interesting.
It does sound interesting. It'll be interesting to see how the French perceive us, at least in 1953. And I don't know. It seems like they to choose a film with an American subject is kind of complimentary. You never think the French being very enamored of America.
We'll have to see how that turns out. And that's in French with English subtitles. Seven Samurai, of course, is in Japanese with English subtitles.
So I guess let's run down the list of films here on this billet, and then we can maybe talk a little bit about upcoming that aren't on the list here.
Okay.
July 23rd and 25th through the 25th is The Seven Samurai, followed by July 30th through August 1st, The Mad Magician in Three Dimensions. Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall on August 6th through the 8th in To Have and To Have Not, followed by Summertime August 20th through the 22nd, and followed lastly by August 27th through the 29th, The Wages of Fear.
Right.
It looks like a real good selection of films. They're all around the 50s, too, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm. We just picked a few gems out of the 50s.
Yeah, international and local. It'll be interesting, kind of a flashback to a time when I was just a wee lad.
Right, Robert.
What other things do you have planned for the upcoming, for winter?
Well, we are still hoping to get Carmen, the flamenco film.
I didn't get to see that. I was just outside down in the Bay Area, and I didn't get to see it, but I got about five different rave reviews about the film.
I want to see that film. It's not out in 16mm yet, but it should be in the fall, so we hope to show that before Christmas time anyway. And El Norte, story of people immigrating from the South, coming up to America, a brother and a sister. That's also not in 16 yet. But I have two things scheduled after this flyer is finished, and that's That Sinking Feeling by the director of Local Hero and Gregory's Girl. It's his first film.
It's his first film?
Yeah, it's his first film. It was kind of buried.
And that was with a lot of the cast
that he chose for Gregory's Girl because it was a high school? Or?
Yeah, they're high school guys that steal kitchen sinks. For it's kind of for kicks, I guess. It sounds crazy, you know, that sinking feeling. They call that their ill-gotten drains.
Oh, enough.
Well, so we thought we'd give that one a try. And then we have scheduled in September And the Ship Sails On, the Fellini film.
Oh,
his newest one.
Well, that would be exciting. Have you heard anything about it?
It's about it has a strange plot. It's a ship full of strange characters, and I think their destination is to bury an opera singer on an island, something like that. And all kinds of things that happen in between, but mostly the characters on the ship.
Sounds like Fellini.
Yes, uh-huh.
Well, good. I'll look forward to both of those, and I'm really looking forward to the seventh time. Actually, all the films should be a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to seeing them. And that's Alaskaland Cinema, and it's at Alaskaland.
Right. And Monday through Wednesday is our regular show date. And I'd like to mention the poster we had.
Oh, yes, that's a beautiful poster. Please do.
We have a poster developed for the theater to represent the theater, and it's a picture of Charlie Chaplin in a scene from The Gold Rush. And it has a dog sled and mountains and Charlie Chaplin with sitting on a steamer trunk with film hanging out of it. It says Alaskaland Cinema, Fairbanks, Alaska at the bottom. And the northern lights are film sprockets,
that's,
you know,
really
celluloid
clever.
Aurora.
Yeah.
We had it developed by an artist in Montana named Monty Dolak, and he's developed posters for several other theaters in the country. So
really?
We're real excited about
it. It's a very handsome poster.
You can see it at the theater, and you can purchase it at the theater also.
All right. Well, thank you, Laurel, for stopping by again and talking about it. And we'll see you, in about 5 weeks.
Thank you, Robert.
That was Laurel Stalky of Alaskaland Cinema. You should remember all shows start at 8 p.m. Well, that about wraps it up for tonight. I hope you'll join us in 2 weeks for a special look at the writings and personality of Stanley Elkin. Until then, for KUAC, I'm Robert Gilfillan. Take care.